Welcome to the 17th episode of Steel Watching, which is a podcast for Remington Steel fans. My name is Sarah, and I am one of the hosts, presenters, someone having an identity crisis. Go.
Pick one. I don't care. I'm easy with it. I'm Eric. I'm the other //.
We don't know.
Hey, before we get into the details and so on, I would like to, if I can, Sarah, take the opportunity to mention that we have added a monthly support option. You can get to it by visiting our website. In addition to the Buy Me a Coffee, which was a flat $5 donation one time, in addition to the PayPal, which is an open value donation one time, you can now send us a small support each month. As little as $3 is the starting figure and up to $10. Just as a way of you helping support the podcast and helping cover some of the costs that we've got. Not an obligation. It's always going to be free for you to listen to. But if you want to participate by helping us cover the costs in bringing this to you, that would be most appreciated. And of course, we still have the merch store. But anyway, enough of the small talk, enough of the non-essential details. Let's get into the show.
Yes, let's do that. So we're going to be talking about the episode Steel Among the Living. And this one first aired February 25th, 1983, and was written by Andrew Laskos and directed by Nick Hovinga. And for this one, I looked at both the TV guide listing and the production synopsis, and I didn't love either of them. So I've put both of them because I couldn't decide. And yeah, I put both of them and because I can't decide on which one. So I'm going to read them both because one okay. I find is just one run on sentence and the other was like so detailed. It was odd. So the TV guide listing said, and I'm going to take a deep breath here because this is literally all one sentence. The paintings of a vanished artist begin to soar in value as Laura and Remington search for a body amid mounting evidence that the painter's demise may profit for her estranged husband and the gallery about to open her one-woman show. Okay, so, yeah, one sentence.
I would say the TV guide folks just lost points. I mean, they've done so well in the past.
I would say that, too. They were doing so good. Yes. And so here's the production synopsis. When an artist is apparently murdered, Laura and Remington find a number of suspects, but no body or paintings. Evidence of the apparent murder points to the artist's young, handsome husband, Teddy, who has been seeing a younger woman, Marion Travis. Teddy hires private eye Leo Blitzman to determine if Marion was involved, and she in turn hires Laura and Remington to establish Teddy's innocence. So I felt like that one was too much. Mm-hmm. It gave a bit too much away, and the first one was just confusing. And I wonder if it's just... So I guess this is maybe my first question. I wonder if it's just that the plot itself is a bit hard to describe because there's a lot going on in this one. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot going on, but I think that it could have been synopsized much more efficiently.
Is that a verb?
An artist disappears and is presumed dead, but no body is found. Her husband is a suspect. The husband's girlfriend is also a suspect, and Steele and Laura investigate. I mean,
well, TV Guide should hire you. Why aren't you doing the job?
Are they still in business?
No, I well maybe I don't know. I haven't seen one in years.
I haven't either.
Some I don't know.
With all the streaming,
if anyone knows, please tell us.
Yeah, with all the streaming, I mean, I can't. They used to have a value when we had like three major networks, and then a local somewhere that was doing reruns of 20-year-old TV shows, and everything was on a set schedule. And so that kind of a situation worked well for TV Guide. But now with all the streaming and such, I cannot imagine that they have much of a market left, if they even exist.
I assume if there was still a TV Guide, it would only focus on cable network television channels. I doubt it would handle any of the streaming networks streaming channels because those are their own entity, right? Like, but what's interesting is that CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, which is our publicly funded network, has now announced that they are going to go fully streaming. Mm-hmm. They're no longer going to be network TV, which I find really an interesting decision. But anyway, you're right. But if anyone knows if TV Guide still exists, be nice to know.
Yeah. I can't imagine that anybody is really watching much in the way of network channels anymore, even on cable systems. I mean, I don't have cable TV. Well, I'll clarify that. I don't watch cable TV. We have a cable TV account for a family member who lives with us, but I don't watch it. And they use an app.
No, we don't have it either.
They use an app. They don't use a box anymore. And much of their content is streaming. Yes, they have the traditional cable network channels, you know, the Cowboy Channel, the Home Decoration Channel, whatever. And so those things do have something of a set schedule, but also so much of those channels' content is available in a streaming format on demand. So, true. You know, again,
yeah.
Where's the market for TV Guide? I don't really see it anymore. But anyway.
Yeah, it's probably not there. Okay.
TV Guide, you're fired.
So, yeah, you're already obsolete, but if you weren't, yes. You're fired.
Yes.
So we get our opening scene. Mm-hmm. And again, Mike, I have a question. We see this couple on a beach. They're frolicking. This is the literal definition of a frolic. I can't seem to figure out if this is supposed... It's not supposed to be Teddy and Rena, right? Is it... And if it isn't, why are we seeing this weird couple that are laughing and running on a beach before we go to the party?
Well, there's a few shots from certain angles where the woman in her face appears very similar to Rena. But yeah, I kind of had that same question in my mind. So I went back and watched it a couple of times, you know, and just kind of stopped periodic points and tried to figure it out. And I don't think it's supposed to be. And in looking at the script, it doesn't suggest that it is Teddy and Rena. No, it just says
young woman and young man. So.
Exactly. I think it's just they're attempting to establish that they're at a beach somewhere. It seems pointless to me.
Just show the water.
Yeah.
They're in LA. Just show the water. We get
Or show the people standing in front of one of the big picturesque windows that they've got there in the scene where they can see the ocean behind them.
Yeah.
Did we really need that scene? I don't think so.
Yeah. But we go to the party. We hear a glass smash, and it's Rena telling Teddy that that's what she does to things that bore her. So we're immediately introduced to this very wealthy, very drunk woman, and she's demanding that he get her another drink. He tells her she's had enough. She goes on to say, of what of you? And this is clearly the definition of crazy eyes. She calls him stupid and a nobody. And here's the thing. Nobody does anything to intervene because according to, I think it's Noah, the party was getting dull anyway.
Yes.
So these are obviously the wealthy elite. And then we get Marion Travers, who is, you know, kind of a somewhat mousy looking brunette, sort of offers to get Rena's drink, saying she will get her whatever she wants. And then we find out that Rena knows that she's also having relations with her husband. She demands to know what Teddy sees in Marion, insults her painting, and the fact that she has no money implies that she is only good for one thing. And Marion, of course, then runs off.
Rena is a real, I mean, the term train wreck just doesn't even go far enough to describe it. The only thing I can think of is a variation of a classic TV theme song. Bewitch, bewitch, such a bewitch. Yeah. I mean, she is.
She's.
Oh.
Yeah.
She's terrible.
She's a piece of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a real piece of work. And it's hard to imagine, you know, was she this way when Teddy married her? I can't imagine anybody with this personality, this sort of an abusive attitude and personality toward anybody getting married. I mean, either that or the person they married is really, really...
Well, he does freely admit that he married her for the money, for the easy life. I can't imagine this life would be so easy with somebody like that. But no.
I don't think it was worth it.
He's clearly not the... And here's where my first sort of criticism of Teddy comes in, because we see when she's verbally abusing him, and she is verbally abusive, extremely so, he slaps the drink out of her hand and he lifts a fist to her and then says, "Rena, right now I could." And then she, of course, replies with, "Kiss me." And are we supposed to feel sorry for any of these people? Rena is awful. She's clearly verbally abusive. And Teddy just threatened to hit his wife in front of an audience. And Marion, she's sleeping with a married man. I mean, as nice as she seems, she's not as...
There's not a lot of likable people here so far.
No. And not only that, we're supposed to believe, and this is, I guess, my main issue throughout the episode, we are supposed to believe that Teddy is innocent because Laura is trying to prove it, I guess. She's hired by Marion later on, and Marion insists he's innocent, so Laura is trying to prove his innocence. But the opening scene shows him almost hitting his wife in front of a group of people. As horrible as she is, this does not strike me as somebody that you would give the benefit of a doubt to.
Well,
what do you think?
From within the context of the episode, Laura is probably not aware of this scene, at least initially when she takes the case. But no, it does not work in his favor. It does not make us want to be too sympathetic for him. I mean, it's one of those situations where on the one hand, you kind of feel sorry for him, but you can't really feel too sorry for him because, one, he created the situation, and two, he's not really that much better than her.
No.
So, no, not a lot of sympathetic people here.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's pretty much the end of that scene after he storms off. And then we switch to Rena. This is a weird, weird scene, too, because she's laughing. The party's over. She's cackling to her, literally cackling. Mm-hmm. So the first scene, we get a literal frolic, and this is a literal cackle. Everyone's left. It's dark. She takes off her wrap. And it's interesting because I thought she was supposed to still be drunk. And this makes sense. The script describes her weaving around from poor eyesight more than drink. Which, of course, we realize that's because she does have a degenerative eye condition. So that part makes sense. But
right. Although we don't find out about that until much later.
No. So we are to assume that she's drunk still.
Right.
She takes off her wrap. She goes over to the easel. She picks up the paintbrush. She's caressing herself with it, which is weird. So this whole thing confuses me for a couple of reasons. One, if she was planning to paint, shouldn't she put on an apron or take off that really expensive dress or something? And two, this is supposed to be the staging of her death, correct?
Yes. We find that out later, yes.
She knows someone's behind her. She says, "Oh, it's you." Asks him to forgive her for the spectacle and says they will cause a sensation together. He picks up the trowel. And then it cuts, but it looks like it obviously is meant to look like he's stabbing her to death. So what was he doing with the trowel, if not killing her? Because we know that that's not where she dies.
Yeah. And I have this in my notes is if this is the actual murder, which we know it isn't later, we find out later, it suggests that the murderer was at the party. But once we find out who the actual murderer is, we can look back at this party and can't find the murderer in the party scenes.
No. And there's also a scream.
So if this is not the actual murder, why show it?
Yeah.
Show that, you know, the guy right? with the trowel looking like he's going about ready to stab her. That is a total, that it's a bad misdirect. I mean, it's not even honest.
It is.
It's not even an honest take on this.
No, because it made me confused while watching when the rest of the story is revealed. Mm-hmm. I had to go back and not just this time, but in previous watches, I've had to wait a minute. Then what happened in the studio?
It's deliberately designed to be confusing, and it's dishonestly confusing because it's not a legitimate piece of evidence. It's not a legitimate red herring.
It's just sort of meant to confuse the audience, which it works, but then it kind of makes the rest of the story seem a bit muddled.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess those were my... And obviously she's not planning to paint, but I don't know. Anyway, so we switch. Mm-hmm. Laura is taking a sculpture class. So she's got some metal sculpture in front of her. And the instructor, who we later learn is named Giovanni, comes over, praises it, saying that they are snapping and snarling. And she says they are lovers. And he agrees that they are lovers who are snapping and snarling. So kind of the epitome of her and Mr. Steele. What do we think?
You mean the sculpture?
Yeah. Well, the metaphor for her and Mr. Steele being lovers who are snapping and snarling.
Well, I suppose so. I didn't actually think of it in that way. My thoughts were on Giovanni. And what a, I'm going to say, sleazeball in a sense.
Yeah.
Because it's, oh, I'm going to make this profound statement that's totally wrong. It has absolutely nothing to do with what I was trying to say. Oh, well, of course not. I knew that. You know, it's like, oh, there was a deal here a number of years ago where it was at some big time museum. And some guy wandering through there decided to have a go at everybody. And he had some sort of a placard or something, or he found one. And so he took his glasses off and set them on the floor and stepped back. And people were walking by. Oh, it's a magnificent piece of art. Oh, it says so much. You know, and, oh, the artist was trying to talk to us about the concept of our vision and how our vision is distorted and we need these. And it was just some guy who was he was trolling them. He left them there as a prank. And this is what Giovanni reminds me of. He's the pretentious prig who got fooled, but doesn't want to admit that he was suckered into something because he wants to sound pretentious. And that's,
what's that old saying? Just because somebody doesn't understand you doesn't make you an artist.
Yeah, there's something like that. Yes. But no, that's Giovanni. Just that was where I was kind of focusing as my attention is Giovanni. Yeah, he's the kind of guy that I could imagine. He runs an art class for a bunch of blue haired old ladies, to call back to an episode. And he charges them big money and tells them, oh, you know, you're so wonderful, you're so fantastic. And it's like, okay, I'm collecting my money, get out of here, next class.
Yep.
You know, it's just,
we need extra sessions.
Yes.
We need more sessions.
And if you're good looking, if you're young and good looking, we'll have some extra sessions in private.
Exactly. And I kind of, to be honest, Leo's sculpture, as terrible as it was, actually had a very clear meaning.
Yeah.
Which was kind of funny.
Mr. Beer Cans.
Like the trash on TV, right? It was not exactly original.
Yeah. But I mean, it's at least as much art as a banana duct taped to a wall, which was a real thing and presented as being $120,000 worth of art.
Yep. I remember.
Unbelievable.
Somebody would pay that too. That's the worst part.
Yes. And then they had to keep replacing the banana.
Because it would go bad.
Or there was actually an incident where one guy walked up and took it off the wall and ate it.
Oh, no, thank you. No, thank you. That's nasty. I will say, it's interesting to see that this is one of her hobbies, because we see a bunch of hobbies throughout the show of hers. Her hobbies, while artistic, the other ones we've seen tend to be more, quote, feminine in nature. So we know she can play the piano, she can dance, she was a gymnast, she is fairly good at trapeze work, as we see later in the series. She can work, but here we see her working with her hands to create art out of old car parts, which is, I mean, regardless of what the sculpture is supposed to be, it's pretty cool. She's got a blowtorch and the eye protection and whatnot. So it kind of gives us a different side to her, as well as a bit of insight with her sculpture, that she's using these ugly car parts to create something called the Lovers, right? So I don't know. I think this was a kind of interesting reveal for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly a different recreational activity than, or a different hobby than we see her involved in at other times. And I don't know that I would necessarily say that, I don't know if I'd necessarily say that all of her other hobbies are strictly feminine in nature, but they are a little bit more mainstream, traditional, prep school type.
Yes.
Type activities.
Middle class.
Yeah.
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 Maybe that's where I'm. So we've got Leo Blitzman. He shows up.
Lovers, huh?
Claims
that's the kind of sex life you got. Sculpture. Now this here, this makes a statement.
I mean, it does. It's not original in any way, but.
No.
And then we've got Marion, who approaches her. This is funny. And then she says she's heard from the other students that her work is, and then bursts into tears. And Laura's like, is it really that bad?
Yeah. And then a hard cut.
Which I like. Yep. Yeah, she's brought Laura to Rena's house.
That's really bad.
And shows, yeah. And shows her the crime scene. And Laura agrees that it looks bad. Marion says it gets worse. And that Teddy told the police he was with her that night when he wasn't. Laura is surprised that she backed him up, which makes Teddy look even more guilty. And at this point, I say, ethics? Should Laura be informing the police that she has information of the whereabouts of a known murder suspect? Maybe? Mm. I mean, they're looking for him.
Well, she doesn't really know where he's at this point.
True.
She does know that Marion lied and backed up Teddy's false alibi, which, I mean, at least she's honest about that to Laura.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that says something in her favor, but yeah. Yeah. Not a lot of really likable people so far in this episode.
No. And then, I mean, Laura is initially suspicious of Teddy as well, even though Marion's insisting that Teddy is innocent. She's also, what's interesting is that she's somewhat disapproving of their relationship, and her comment about not getting to choose who you fall in love with hits home for Laura. I think that's why she agrees to help, but I also kind of wonder, isn't that a bit of a cop-out? I mean, you can't control who you fall in love with, but you can control the way you respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not covering up the tracks of somebody or getting involved with the married man is.
Yeah. I mean, if you're getting involved with somebody that you know you shouldn't be because of something such as them being married or you being married, then yeah, you kind of can choose who you fall in love with because you made the choice to get into that relationship. And so the consequences of that choice, yeah, you did choose those. You may not have intended to go down that route, but you made the decision to start down that route. And so where you end up is really a consequence of your initial choice. So, yeah, it's kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. But I do think that's why Laura agrees to help. I think that statement kind of hits Laura in a way because she does obviously have feelings for Mr. Steele and they're in this weird place where they're kind of acknowledging it, but not really going forward fully with it. So she feels a bit of sympathy for Marion.
Mm-hmm.
That's why she does what she does. But so then we go to the next scene and we've got Steele overseeing some major redecorating in the office. They've got a painter with three color examples up on the wall. They're varying shades of blue, which is interesting because the script says green. And Steele doesn't think it's right, claiming the office needs vitality and passion. I'm wondering, obviously Laura knows about this whole office redecoration, but putting him in charge of it seems like a bad plan because of his tendency to overspend. And I actually really like the blue. What do you think?
Well, yeah, the first question I had in this scene that I wrote down is, why is Steele making paint color decisions?
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
It's coming off as if he is the boss and, you know, he's making these decisions because it's his office and his agency and such. And it's not. Is this an attempt by Laura to make him feel like he's kind of in charge or part of the team or what's the reason behind the decision?
I don't know. Like, when I saw this scene, my question I wrote was, did Laura okay this? Who is reining him in? Why are Murphy and Bernice just going along with it? So, yeah, I kind of wondered the same thing.
The fact that Bernice and Murphy are going along with it suggests that Laura okayed it. But I'm back to that same question I had a minute ago. Why did she okay this? Why did she put him in charge of this?
I mean, maybe to distract him from actual detective cases, but then if it were a distracting tactic, she wouldn't probably have Murphy moving around furniture. She'd probably have Murphy taking clients with her. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It seems an odd scenario.
But I like the blue.
The colors, the teal, the kind of the darker teal, not the real dark one, not the real light one.
Right.
The middle one. And we're discussing it like we're actually repainting the office here.
Yeah, like it's our job here to repaint.
That's right.
So, yeah, he calls for vitality and passion. And then the phone rings. And this is where he picks it up. It's Giovanni, which is, I wondered how Giovanni knows to call her at work.
Yeah.
But sure. Okay. He says that he didn't say enough last night, that Laura was magnifico, and he can't wait until next week for the lovers to progress. So Steele, pretty shocked by this. Giovanni goes on to say that she was splendid, inspiring, and fantastic, to which Steele begs him to stop.
Yeah, Steele just, he goes off and runs the wrong way with the evidence and assumes facts not in evidence, and yeah.
To be fair, though, this one is pretty misleading.
Mm-hmm.
I can sort of forgive him for making it. This was not a jumping to conclusions. He took a tiny step, and there the conclusions were, you know. So,
I think he took several steps, but yeah, and certainly it did. It was presented to him in a way that made it easy to jump to those conclusions. But
yeah. So then my question.
Did you catch the continuity error?
No.
Just before the phone rings, you know, this is when Steele said needs passion. And the painter guy says, passion, I've got it. You can see a red swatch on the wall at the right edge of the frame.
Yeah. That's literally the color of all the other walls.
And then it disappears in the next couple of shots. And then then he puts it back on. So, yeah. So, something in that, I haven't looked at the script to see where they changed that around, because I do know that they made some other changes. For example, the comment earlier about the party was just getting dull was originally supposed to be Spriggs, not Devereaux. So
they've
rearranged some things, definitely. And I don't know if it was rearranged when they wrote, when they were rewriting the script, or if they rearranged things in editing.
It looks like he wasn't supposed to put the red up until after he hangs up with Giovanni.
Mm-hmm. Except that the line, passion, I've got it, I got it, comes in sequence in the script exactly in the same way it does in the episode. So I'm not sure what happened there. Anyway.
Yeah, good question. So my question is why, other than for comedy,
mm-hmm.
do you think that Steele doesn't just come out and say, hey, I just took a call from Giovanni. Who is that?
Well,
I mean, he's literally being asked to deliver a message to Laura. Mm-hmm. Why not just say, I just got a weird phone call. Who is this Giovanni person?
Since you asked the question, I'm going to say something I was going to not say.
Oh, this sounds intriguing.
Yes. This is not one of the better scripts in many respects. And this is an example of it. It seems that it was somebody who was writing a script and they were more interested in creating situations for the comic value.
Yeah.
Rather than creating a scenario and a story which made sense in the context of the series, in the context of the episode, and then letting the humor come from the natural progression of the story. It was like, oh, we've got a bunch of little bits here. Let's put them together and make a script.
I agree.
And it's derivative. The whole Remington and Laura scenario evolves to the point where he's trying to back out. And it's, you remember the, I've got it written down somewhere else later in my notes. The episode where she says, I know what you're doing. You think that by continuing to bow out, I'll drag you back in.
Yeah, that was...
That's the same situation that we're
Maury
seeing.
Maury Singer.
Yes. Yes. To stop a steal. Thank you. But this that's the same type of thing that we see going on here in this episode. So I hate to say it. I don't want to badmouth somebody's hard work, but it's not one of the better constructed and better created scripts that we have in this first season, especially.
This might have also been one of the cases of a script being written and then being changed or punched up or something being mm-hmm. done to it. I mean, I don't know for sure, but it's always possible. And I will add that I can kind of give it a bit of a pass in some moments, but mainly because I can see some of the potential with it. You could have still done this idea as long as you could maintain the momentum enough so that Steele never gets the chance to have that conversation with her.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And keep it's him done separated. Similar. Yeah. Or have him, you know, he tries to ask the question, then a suspect interrupts him, or there's a car chase or something that, and they do that for a little bit, but eventually it becomes a matter of, oh, Laura figures out that he thinks Giovanni is her lover and decides to play with him. And then it turns into a whole thing. But if you think about, and I'm jumping ahead here, spoilers, Steele blushing in season 4 when he sees the picture of her and mm-hmm. thinks that it's her. That's really well done. That's funny. He's trying to figure out what's going on throughout that whole episode. And it's done in a way that it keeps him from being able to outright ask the question until, of course, he does and she storms off. But yeah, I think you're right that this is just, he had an opportunity here just to say, hey, I got a phone call. Can you tell me who Giovanni is? And doesn't, because he's too busy. The wheels are turning. And I guess if we're going to try to put a character angle on it, I think it maybe shows that he doesn't feel secure enough in their relationship. If we're going to take aside the fact that it's maybe not the best constructed script, but mm-hmm. that he doesn't feel secure enough in the relationship to question what she does in her own time, which also means that he's aware that they aren't exclusive and there's not really an effort that's been made to be exclusive. That's my theory, if I'm going to try to find a theory. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it's a tough one to explain because it just doesn't make any sense to begin with. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. Anyway.
Laura comes in. She's telling Marion to forgive their decorating and directs her to an office. Steele sees her and she introduces Marion. Marion says that Laura is wonderful, and Steele is still bothered by things. He does tell her he just received a phone call that requires an immediate conference. And Laura, this is where I say that they kind of managed to kick the ball a little bit. Because Laura says, whatever it is, we'll have to wait. She invites Murphy and Bernice both in the office to talk to Marion. What's with the triumphant little walk that Bernice does past Steele? She does this little like hop as if to say, haha, but I don't really get if, why? There's nothing in the script that calls for it. So I don't know. Did you notice that?
I didn't.
It's like a cute little, yeah, it might have just been Janet DeMay playing around, but it was cute. And then of course, Daryl asks about the colors. Steele, seeing red, still says it's red, which great line.
Yeah.
So we've got a scene change. Marion is still claiming that Teddy is innocent, that he married Rena for the money, and that she says he's beautiful and guys like him get used to the easy life. And I get, this is something I wasn't going to say, but since you said your thing, I'm going to say mine. I'm not one to criticize a person's appearance, but if this guy is supposed to, if he's supposed to be basically a dumb himbo, which is kind of how he's never heard that portrayed. Oh, no? You never heard himbo? It's like a bimbo, but, you know, a dude. So if he's supposed to be a dumb himbo, they didn't exactly pick Brad Pitt here. Like, he, to me, looks like an ordinary person that I could walk by on the street and maybe not give a second look to.
Yeah, you know, and Marion's description of him really doesn't improve our perception of him. I mean, no. She makes him sound like a pet.
It doesn't. Yeah. It's so does.
I mean, not Rita even a gigolo. He's just a pet.
Yeah. She says, yeah, because they describe him that way later too. Noah and Devereaux and Spriggs. I think it's Devereaux makes a comment about him being a pet as well.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I hadn't even made that connection. But yeah. You're right. He does. He said animals like that are dangerous.
Need to be put down. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. But I mean, she isn't doing him any favors.
No. She then says that Rena likes to own things, which I've got in my notes, not exactly selling dear old Teddy here. He does not seem like a prize. She says some relationships don't go the way you expect. Steele makes a cryptic response. And then Marion claims that Teddy can't leave because Rena was blackmailing him, but that he wouldn't tell her with what. Here's my question. Why does she want this man? He's a very definition of a walking red flag. Throw the whole man back. What do you think?
You know, sometimes you look at two people and think they deserve each other. And sometimes that's a good thing. And sometimes that's a negative thing. And in this case, it's a negative thing. I mean, yeah. Teddy is not, you know, there's that old saying, not the sharpest tool in the shed. Teddy's not even in the shed.
No. He's got the IQ of a piece of chalk.
And that's insulting to chalk. and Marion is only marginally better.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I suppose, you know, there's that thing, that idea that for everybody in the world, there's somebody. And I think these two are their somebodies. They are.
These are lobster.
They're just, they're not bright people. And that's the only explanation I can think of for why she would want him is because he, for whatever reason, fits her ideals, and her ideals are questionable, low dumb rent, and whatever.
Dumb and obedient. She should just get a golden retriever and get rid of Teddy.
Yeah.
Be a better plan all around, I think. So Steele then becomes his usual drama queen self.
Mm-hmm. That's what I got written right there. With a drama queen.
Nice.
Yeah, he goes into his wounded act. Dealing
with a man trapped to the very apex of a lover's triangle. On the one hand, true love. On the other hand, a hollow commitment fueled by nothing more than cheap carnal lust. And of course, Laura tries to rein him in, but before she can, he asks, could a man
faced with such an excruciating dilemma resort to murder?
Oh, dear.
Like, and of course, Laura has no clue what he's talking about.
She's face palming at this point. She's just, oh, dear God. Right? Like,
you know, and she doesn't have a clue, which makes all his comments and his sarcasm and the snide attitude pointless. I mean, it's only worthwhile if they get it. And she doesn't get it.
She's just wondering what the hell's going on with him. Like, why are you being, you know, this guy at this moment? So, it's funny. But it is also a bit ridiculous.
Yes.
And then you've got, she's taking him to task in the next scene over his whole apex of a lover's triangle speech, almost literally calling him a drama queen. Mm-hmm. And he tries again to change the subject to last night. He called her. This is where he could have said, this is it, right? And she doesn't tell him about the sculpture class. Why? She says she was busy with some work, nuts and bolts kind of thing. He makes his American or foreign comment, which is funny as he's not exactly American made either. But
no.
Why doesn't she just say, oh, I'm taking a sculpture class on Tuesday nights? Why hide it aside from the script? Or is it just the script demands it?
I think it's the script demands it. I think they were just trying to create scenarios for the sake of comedy rather than allow the story to create scenarios and allow the story to create the comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And this actually is the part that makes less sense to me than Steele jumping to conclusions from the phone call. I could see him jumping to conclusions from the phone call.
Yeah, you can almost excuse that one. I mean, it's still a conclusion.
But her just not saying, by the way, there's no reason for her to hide that she's taking a sculpture class.
I mean, what's the big deal?
That makes no sense to me. It for her as a character, she's not the kind of person that is secretive about her life. Mm-mm. He's the one that doesn't open up. Mm-hmm. So yeah, to me, this is the script demands that she lie about where she was. So she's going to lie about where she was. And I thought, well, that's silly. It could just be that they're already in the gallery and he doesn't get the chance to ask the question. But no, it doesn't. She lies about it. And then that, of course, makes him more suspicious, which it would. If I were Steele at this point and I've gotten that weird phone call and I've asked where she was last night and she's basically said that she was busy and not told me anything, then yeah, I'm going to keep taking more steps to the conclusions.
Yeah.
I'm going to continue my little walk. So yeah, they go into Sprague's art gallery. They hear them arguing and Laura pops her head in and asks Sprague for help. He tries to pawn them off on an employee, but she's too busy watching her damn soap operas, which was funny because you never see her.
Well, you never see her. If she's that worthless, why is she still working there?
Yeah, why is she still working there? And why he complains about having put a TV in.
Yeah.
Why put a TV in? That's weird.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's a line that's designed, it seems, to be a joke. And don't worry about the rationale behind it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I hate to say this. That's going to keep coming back up through this episode.
Yeah, I think so.
That's not really what I want to do.
Because he says, I'm sure Anita can answer any questions you might have if she can tear herself away from the soap operas. Mm-hmm. I never should have agreed to a television in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. No, I agree with you. And then Laura mentions the party and Rena's disappearance. Spriggs was at the party. Spriggs begins to make a bunch of excuses. And then Devereaux introduces himself. And it's interesting that Steele immediately knows that he's an art critic. I mean, because he would, right? Laura mentions Teddy and Noah describes him, as I said before, as an animal and goes on to call him a walking poster with as much depth.
Yeah.
Which I liked. And then says exotic animals can be dangerous. Mm-hmm. He warned Rena about him, but she didn't listen. So is he saying this because obviously they're both in on this plan to fake Rena's death. So is this just an attempt to divert suspicion, or does he genuinely think that Teddy is also potentially violent? I mean, he did almost hit Rena.
Well, immediately following that exchange, Steele says, well, then you think he killed her. And Devereaux says, well, that's a decision for the police to make.
Yeah.
And my note here is, in Devereaux's voice, let me throw Teddy under the bus, then pretend I didn't.
Yeah.
No, true. I think it's an intentional act on theirs to set Teddy up.
Okay.
And trying to do it in a way that doesn't look like they're setting Teddy up, just making conversation and, I'm sorry. Did I drive the bus over you?
Well, Teddy doesn't exactly make it easy on himself in the sense that a room full of people saw him raise his hand to his wife and then she disappears that night. That's iffy, right?
Yeah.
So,
and it didn't help as Marion had said earlier, that they were up on the hills one night and he told her that he wished that Rena was dead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not great.
Not looking
great.
Yeah. Keeps looking worse and worse.
And I think goes again to your point about how they kind of deserve each other, because if it were me and I'm Marion and I'm putting all these pieces together, my conclusion would be, oh, crap, the married man that I've been having an affair with is a murderer, not, oh, I need to protect him and he's innocent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's not a sweet little cinnamon roll. Like, you know, so I guess she deserves him. But so Laura asks about the showing of Rena's work. Noah says that he's convinced Spriggs that a showing so soon after would appear in bad taste. And it's then we see Leo skulking, not very well, behind a sculpture.
Leo.
He's terrible. He's terrible.
Yeah.
Leo goes to leave. Laura sees him and says, it's the beer cans, which confuses Steele.
Yep.
And then she says to stop him. They both go running after him. They chase him around the corner.
She's hiding behind a cardboard box.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. It was that I don't wear heels. I don't like heels. I don't walk well in heels. And walking is a challenge for me. So that was impressive because Stephanie did all of those runs. I mean, obviously she had a stunt double for intricate stuff, but the running and chasing and heels, that was all her. So mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive. And then Steel drops a brick on Leo's foot. Would that not break a toe or two?
And wasn't it just handy that the whole pallet full of bricks was sitting there right next to where Leo decided to hide?
Right.
I don't know if it would necessarily break a toe, but it certainly wouldn't feel good. It would probably be painful for quite a while. I guess it would depend on how the brick hit the toe.
Yeah.
I can see it going either way. I can see it potentially breaking a toe, or I can see it just being really, really painful for a while.
Yeah. And then, of course, we get his ID. He hands it to Laura, who identifies him as Leo Blitzman. Watch the rough stuff, pretty boy. You're dealing with an eye.
Cannon, man, it's Rockford.
As messed up as the script is in places, Leo's dialogue is hilarious.
Yes.
I and the actor they've got playing Leo, this is another one of those side characters who is just really... The actor is really good. He is really good. He comes across as appropriately sleazy. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Cannon Rockford. He starts naming fictional PIs. Steel is confused, which is, I don't know if I found this. We know he doesn't watch a lot of TV, but he does follow pop culture. So wouldn't he know who at least one or two of them are?
You would think. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I think Cannon would have been before Remington Steele. Mannix and Rockford would have been a little bit before, not necessarily a whole lot. So they may have been recent enough that he isn't necessarily immediately aware of them. Yeah, because he is
in a more classic.
Yeah. You know, and if somebody...
Old Hollywood.
If somebody talked to him about it and he saw part of it, one of the episodes of Cannon or Mannix or Rockford on a TV show, he might recognize it, but maybe in this particular context, it doesn't click with him because he's not that familiar with them. But yeah.
True.
The whole idea that Leo thinks that these are the epitome of private eyes is funny.
It is funny, especially when he says that his middle name is Divorce. So obviously he's not exactly handling like high powered clients.
Well, and then when Laura describes his past experience, it's
weren't you in charge?
He gets
of
my vote for the
security.
Worst private investigator ever.
Oh, he's really bad. Yeah.
Yes.
She mentions a couple of things where he's instances where he majorly screwed up. And then she tells him to stay put or Mr. Steele will shoot him.
With what?
That's an odd threat for her.
Well, especially since they can never find the agency gun or the bullets for it.
True.
Yeah, you know, and it's obvious that Steele in that finely tailored suit isn't carrying a weapon.
No, no. And he, credit to Pierce Brosnan, his face when she says that Mr. Steele will shoot you is
it's like,
pretty good. I will, which is nice. And then here's a question. She says, you're not going to like this, but we have to let him go. Of course they do. What's the alternative? They're not police.
No. And even if he had some evidence, even if he had some evidence and they wanted him to talk to the police about it, that would be one of those pot calling the kettle black situations, because they are just as guilty of holding back information as he would have been.
Yeah. I mean, he knows where Teddy is, but they also know that Marion and Teddy lied about their alibis. So, yeah.
And not to mention all the things they've done in the past that were questionable and probably not legal.
Exactly. So, I think they let him go. Here's another question that I have. They're following his beater of a car, and the script calls it, and this is, I spent the whole episode trying to get a look at what kind of car he was driving.
AMC Pacer.
Okay, because this is where my question was, because this last time we did this with Hearts of Steel, the script called it a Maserati, but it was clearly a Jaguar. The script here calls it an American Motors Marlin. So did they switch cars, or is that the same? I've never heard of these cars.
No, yeah. It's a totally different vehicle than what they've got. What he's driving is an AMC Pacer, which was not produced for very many years. It was not well liked by a lot of people, although it was, in terms of the automotive technology, a fairly advanced car for its time. It introduced or was one of the few cars that used some advanced automotive technologies that later became standard across the industry. And, you know, you look at the design of it, it's got huge windows, it's got great visibility. It was designed to National Highway Transportation safety standards that didn't even exist yet. They were proposed and had been scheduled to be implemented a couple of years down the road. And then, of course, they changed their mind because the big three convinced them that it would just be too expensive to make cars that meet the standard. But this car met those standards several years prior to that. So it was, I loved that car. I would have loved to have had one of those cars. I thought they were cool.
It was I mean, they're obviously portraying it as a beater, but it was a cool little car. And I thought that's why I was trying to figure out what it was, because I kept thinking, I've never seen a car like that before, but I don't know what kind it is. And what's also interesting is when they're following him, when you see Leo driving his car in frame, you also see a tan colored rabbit pass by, which I thought was Laura's at first, and then you see that they're following in the limo. So
I did not catch that.
That's also, I got it. And I was like, oh, it's a rabbit, but it's not Laura, because it's the wrong color and it's going the wrong way. So,
and of course, Leo's car is as bad as Maury's in The Stop of Steel. Yes. I mean, they're both in, they're both in terrible condition.
Yeah, how does one let an automobile get in this condition? And another good comparison to Leo and Maury Singer is that the score for both of them is very sprightly and upbeat and kind of goofy, which we're meant to think that that's who Leo is. And of course, we find out later that, I mean, I don't even know if I can call him a murderer. I mean, he chased her, but she fell down the elevator.
Spriggs. Spriggs.
Well,
Spriggs wound up with
Leo.
Leo accidentally killed Rena, but Spriggs was intentionally killed.
Yes, yes, but Leo didn't kill Spriggs. Devereaux did.
Are you sure about that?
I wasn't at first. The script says that he did, and he kind of confesses to it when they're. I watched that scene a couple times. So Devereaux kills Spriggs, but Leo was the one who accidentally got Rena. It was kind of a twofer.
See, I didn't get that out of it. I thought that they kind of left Spriggs undefined, and we were supposed to presume that Leo did it trying to cover it up after he killed Rena and was trying to abscond with the paintings. Interesting.
We'll wait till we get to that scene, and then we'll take a new one.
We'll hash it out, yes. We'll hash it out.
But either way, his score is cute. I like it. And so they, true to character, the score kind of paints Leo as this kind of, again, goofy character. And Steele has done a good job of remaining in the present case, but also appearing irritable and upset as if he has something on his mind. So Brosnan's performance here is pretty good, because even when he's talking about the case, he's got this kind of like glower in his expression, which says that he's still kind of thinking about that phone call, but hasn't really had a chance to dig into it. And this is where he says they need to talk about their personal lives. And he starts to talk about honesty. Laura is focused on the case. She jumps in, says she's suspicious of Spriggs and Devereaux too. He concludes that Spriggs must not have the pictures. She concludes that Spriggs must not have the pictures, remembering that she only saw the slides, and wonders if Rena is dead, where are they? Steele's trying to get a word in edgewise because he can't. And then eventually Fred says that Leo has made them. Leo no turns kidding. And says, you're following. Yeah, right? They're in a limo. It's huge. you're following me in that ocean liner.
Yeah.
And Steele tries to cover it up. He says he's got two ex-wives trying to hunt him down, and they have yet to sprinkle salt on this rooster's tail. Have you ever heard this expression?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because this is the first I've heard of it.
It's an old expression. I didn't look up the origins of it.
Okay.
It's an old one. I remember hearing it long, long time ago, but yeah, I couldn't tell you the etymology of it.
Okay. Yeah, I just thought it was kind of funny. And then Steele instructs Fred not to lose Leo, saying there's only so much insult a man can have added to injury, which is also funny. So we get a little bit of a chase scene. They go into a parking garage, or Leo goes into a parking garage. He thinks he's lost them. He pulls away. Steele and Laura are on the sidewalk. Steele signals a taxi and they get in. Mm-hmm. He says, you learn these tricks when you're constantly avoiding the authorities, which is an interesting little insight sprinkled in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the cabbie asks if he's the $50 tip dispatch called in. Steele says he is, provided she doesn't lose the car. How did dispatch convey the message that fast? And was she just really close?
Yeah. If I had to judge based on the cab service here where I live, this is fantasy. It would never happen. Yeah, they would still be standing there 2 hours later.
Leo would be gone.
And yeah, somebody would have to come along and tell them, no, download the Uber app. And then.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You drive. Yeah. You would know.
Yes. I can't tell you the number of times that I've picked up people and they've told me, this is my first time of using Uber or Lyft or, you know, whichever one it is, because I've been waiting for a cab for 2 hours or 4 hours, or in one case, 6 hours. And somebody finally told me about this app and showed me how to do it. So I hope I'm doing it right. I mean, literally, it's their first ride because they've been waiting for hours for a cab that never showed up.
Wow.
And this is not, this is not Los Angeles.
No. I mean, yeah. So that part was a little bit stretching believability that the cab just shows up right on time and is able to get them. But yeah, sure.
I suppose back then, if you waved a $50 bill in front of a cab driver's face, or, you know, the promise of a $50 bill, that they might jump on it. But yeah, it still seems a little bit out there.
So then we've got a scene change. Leo arrives at the loft. He asks, Teddy is there. He asks if he was followed. Leo says he's a rooster. He's trying to shake hands with your own shadow. Seconds later, there's another knock. The look on Leo's face is pretty funny. He's okay, they're here. Right.
You mentioned that he's a great actor for this part, and he is. And part of it is just because he has some great facial expressions.
Yeah, he really does. and it's revealed that Teddy hired Leo to get close to Marion because he thinks she might have killed Rena, because it was too hard seeing how badly he was being treated. This is, and this is all caps, not a healthy relationship.
Yeah.
Wow. You're hiring a PI because you think your fiance killed your wife.
Yeah. That's not a really good way to start a relationship or, to progress a relationship.
Mm. Hey, honey, remember that time I thought you killed my wife?
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah.
Like,
we're going to celebrate the anniversary of when we thought you killed her.
Yeah. Oh, at this time you were on the run.
Yeah.
Good times. He claims she loves him that much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he freely admits here that he married Rena for the money, but he didn't kill her for it because Rena was broke. Okay. The paintings weren't selling, but she kept spending. He also says that he lost track of what was going on in her life. He admits that he smells guilty because her paintings are now worth more than they were because she's quote unquote dead. And he says Marion rented the place to store her art when she was her junk art that she sells to hotels and whatnot, and that they had plans to convert it into their own space one day. Laura now knows where Teddy is. She's obliged to report this, isn't she?
Yeah, one would think. If you know somebody is being hunted by the police, there's a warrant out for their arrest, you know where they're at and you don't report that, I think it's called aiding and abetting.
Yeah.
It's also potentially
accessory after the fact.
That was the term I was looking for. I just couldn't find it in there. But yeah. And of course, she has a license that she has to protect. And a code of ethics, ? That she's supposed to live by as an investigator.
And if Steele were doing this, right? I mean, think about Veronica Kirk.
She would read him the riot act.
She would up and down. She'd be all over him for flights of fancy or whatever it is. And yet, here she is. So, yeah. Writing. Teddy muses on love. Does love make any sense to you, Steele? Steele says less and less all the time. Looking right at Laura. And then we've got a scene change. They're at Rena's. Laura hangs up the phone with Murphy. Steele asks if the police have been through, and Laura says, cleanup isn't their strong suit. Wouldn't this still be an active crime scene?
You would presume so. But I guess we can make the excuse that, well, there wasn't any crime tape out front, so... But in a real world scenario, that would probably be considered a crime scene at least for several days after the fact.
Yeah.
But, once the police are done there, I guess they would take the tape down. They would allow people back in. And maybe that's the point that we're supposed to be at in this story, is that the police have finished all their forensic work in the studio. And so they've opened it back up.
Yeah, could be that. I mean, Laura finds out that Rena was going blind, hence having so many pairs of glasses. Now, this I thought interesting because she has a degenerative eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa. And I have actually read, I can't remember the name of the book, but I read a book years ago where the main character had the same condition. And an interesting thing about retinitis pigmentosa is it's actually a part of a group of eye disorders that are inherited. And obviously, based on the name, involve the eye's retina. It causes a slow but sure loss or decline in eyesight, and symptoms include, and this is from one of the websites, loss of vision, visual sharpness usually, but the interesting thing is it usually begins in childhood or adolescence. Mm-hmm. So a bit strange that it's suddenly happening to a 40-year-old woman. Currently, there are no treatments for retinitis pigmentosa, but the use of UV sunglasses may help delay the start of symptoms. So one would think they would have noticed this earlier if it starts in childhood.
Yeah. And I was looking at the National Eye Institute website and they said common early symptoms are loss of night vision.
Yeah.
Which, as you said, usually begins in childhood. They tend to lose peripheral vision.
Yeah.
So you eventually wind up with tunnel vision, a sensitivity to bright light, loss of color, the ability to distinguish color. So yeah, you would think that there would have been something more indicative of this happening prior to this. And even though UV glasses will help stave off some of the severity of the effects and the rapidity of them coming on, I don't know how glasses, like for magnifying, would help. Because that doesn't seem to be a part of this condition.
No. No, it isn't. Eventually you go blind.
Yeah. But it's because your vision starts collapsing basically in on itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's... I don't see how the glasses would fit and work, but for the script.
No. Well, and that's... What's frustrating about it is that in the episode... And the title is escaping me, where they go into the sleep clinic. Mm-hmm. They did so much research, accurate research on narcolepsy. Mm-hmm. You'd think that it would be easier to pick something. Like, there's other degenerative eye conditions out there that would have fit this particular scenario.
Yeah.
And they went with retinitis pigmentosa.
Yeah.
I guess they figured that nobody other than us would look it up.
Yeah. Yeah, those lousy podcasters double-checking our facts.
Yeah. And Laura also notices the stain on the wall doesn't match the placement of the easel or that there isn't any blood. Steele quotes the film Laura, Dane Andrews, Gene Tierney, 20th Century Fox, 1944, and mentions that in the film they chase after a woman who staged her death with only a portrait to go on, leading Laura to conclude that Rena staged her death to cash in on the value of her paintings and let Teddy take the rap. And I'm not going to be the first person to insult the local police, but wouldn't they come to the same conclusion?
Well, I suppose it depends on the qualifications and the intelligence of the investigating officer, but you would hope so. You know, my question about it is, though, that how does this work? Okay, so yeah. You get yourself declared dead so that your paintings go up in value and you can get an insurance, life insurance payment.
Yeah.
How do you collect on any of those things if you're supposed to be dead?
That was also my question in the notes, that she wouldn't be able to physically, she'd have to become someone else, basically. And it,
created ahead of time and named as A, her executor of her will, or the person to inherit her paintings, it would have to be named as the recipient, the beneficiary of her life insurance policy. It's just, and this is something that happens in a lot of TV shows and a lot of mysteries, and it just has never made sense. How do you do that? It just doesn't seem to work.
Well, I guess you have to trust your partner's going to physically give you the money. Because she, if I'm correct, she left them to the consortium, right? So that Springs could.
The paintings, yeah.
So, yeah.
That's a lot of trust.
But you're right. It's dumb. It is a lot of trust. And usually criminals in these particular circumstances are not totally trustworthy. So, yeah. Oh,
you think maybe that's what makes them criminals, is that they're not trustworthy?
Maybe. I don't know. Could be. So then we go to Laura and Steele in a limo. She has called Marion. They're going to meet at the loft to reunite them. Laura says the lovers are finally reunited or something like that. And then Steele finally gets up the courage to tell her that he took the phone call from Giovanni. Laura says you weren't supposed to find out. Why?
You know, the only thing I can come up with as, and this kind of goes back to your earlier question about keeping it a secret. The only thing I can come up with is that she was creating the sculpture as a surprise for him. But the fact that you're wanting to keep the sculpture itself as a surprise doesn't mean that you can't tell him, well, you know, I'm taking an art class.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a special project and I don't want to tell you about it right now, but I'm doing something special.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And where I can sort of slot his character into how the plot's manipulating him, it's harder to do that with her because I can't see her being embarrassed about this. I can't see her hiding it. It just seems very silly. She says, so you know about my, and he says lover, and she corrects. She says lover, and he corrects lovers. Or no, other way around.
Yeah.
My brain. Anyway, he's surprised and then says, I knew it was going to be more work. Or she says, I knew it was going to be more work, but I couldn't see doing it any other way. And he looks shocked and says, that's not possible. And she says, well, keeping them both balanced is tricky, but when you're holding a torch like that.
Sounds more like a raging forest fire.
But what he says here is interesting. I consider myself a sophisticated man, and I would never presume to have a monopoly on your affections. But couldn't you confine it to one tryst at a time? We see him grappling with the fact that he feels that he has feelings for her, doesn't want to behave in a way that is possessive or jealous. He's actually trying not to be, but definitely feels threatened, which is it's a huge contrast to the temper tantrum he threw. Where Murphy was concerned, the snide comments and the little jabs at Murphy, and a bit of a contrast to Murphy as well, every time she even looks at Steele in a positive way. Did you kind of, I mean, what were your thoughts on that one?
Well, I didn't necessarily think about it in comparison to his response to Murphy, although, you know, if I was going to try to create a justification for the difference, well, you know, Murphy's a trusted associate and It's one thing to have a tryst behind my back with somebody I don't know, but to do it with somebody that I know and I'm supposed to be able to trust and that sort of thing, that's different. So I can kind of create a sense of logic out of that. But yeah, I was more focused on the fact that this seemed to be a rehash of To Stop a Steal.
Yeah, it is. Very much so.
So that was where my mind was. I got stuck in that rut and couldn't get out of it. So
what's interesting is how there are some lines that were taken out of the script that are an interesting sort of weaving of the case, because in the script, she says, "I knew it was going to be more work, but I couldn't see doing it any other way." He says, "It's not possible." And then she says, "Could you kill me now?" And he says, "I'm not normally a man of violence, but if you're questioning my rage," and then she says, "No, I mean, kill me now as if you were slashing me with a knife. See, Rena must have been standing here because this conversation in the script is taking place in her loft."
Yeah.
Not in the limo.
Yeah.
Right. And this is where they figure out that the blood spatter doesn't make sense. And he says, "How can you be so bloody cavalier? In one breath, the woman for whom I have feelings confesses to seeing a lover, pardon, lovers on Tuesday nights, and in the next breath wants my opinion about the particulars of a case." And then she says, "Wait a minute, you don't think." So obviously they switched the location of that conversation and took that part out. But here's my next question. Why didn't she choose to correct him? Why continue letting him think that this affair is something that she's having?
Yeah, you know, I kind of had a note along those lines, and how could she not know from the beginning that this is what he's thinking, that he thinks that she's having a fling? Because nothing he says makes any sense in any other context. It doesn't make any context in the conversation about the case. It's, again, I can probably make a sort of logical argument within the context of the script that, well, she was so focused on the case, she really wasn't paying attention to what he was saying. And, you know, she was presuming that he knew what she was talking about. And so it made sense to her to talk about it in this way and not clarify that, oh, this is a sculpture. But again, it's designed to serve the script, not the story.
Yeah.
If I can make that distinction. Yeah.
And I mean, I'll give them credit for not. Steele acts like he definitely takes a temper tantrum later and acts very immature. But in this particular scene, he looks stunned enough that he's sort of trying to figure it out. She then goes on to invite him to join her next Tuesday. And he says he doesn't think humor is the right response. And then, of course, they figure out they're being bugged. It's funny when she blows the whistle, though. Leo veers off course into a picnic table. And then they switch. They're back at the loft with Marion. It's dark. They can't find Teddy. Marion is explaining Steele's theory. He's kind of blustering on as he normally does. And, of course, a painting falls down. We find Rena's body, and Teddy is nowhere to be seen. So then we're back at the office. Laura tells Marion that she believes Rena did stage her death, but then someone who knew about it must have killed her. Marion is afraid. She thinks it's Teddy, and Laura says she doesn't believe he did it. Why? Literally all the evidence there points to Teddy. Other than his word, why is Laura so readily able to believe Marion?
Fantasyland. If we accept the notion that these two are really made for each other, they are each other's the one, then their faith is unshakable in spite of all the evidence.
I mean, Bonnie and Clyde were the one for one another, but they still went on a killing spree.
interesting example. But at least both of them knew that the other one was doing it.
True.
In this case, I guess in this case, love is blind and love is stupid. And love is, you
know, and they're both.
Yeah, and love ignores the evidence. Granted, I mean, ultimately they're proven to be correct, but still, I mean, there should be some question in somebody's mind as to why is this evidence pointing to this person? If
Yeah, Laura's mind. Laura's not in love with Teddy. Mm-mm. She should be the one saying, I'm sorry, Rena, but it looks like you're... You know, your one true love might be a killer. And Murphy, this is where I give points to Murphy, because Murphy comes in and he asked to talk to Laura and basically says that his vote is on Teddy, because he says he's got some gambling debts. He embezzled money from Rena to pay them off. She found out about it, had enough evidence to have him convicted. So, ooh, okay, great, great. Great match there. Keeping him on a short string so that he couldn't marry Marion. And he points out that with Rena gone, he's free from conviction, out from under her thumb, and worth a small fortune. So Murphy is talking sense. Mm-hmm. Even if Murphy doesn't prove to be correct, he's talking sense.
Yeah. Based on all the evidence that they've got up to this point.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that's happening is that Bernice pops in to tell her that Daryl says to take his time choosing the paint because he gets paid by the hour. What? Do, huh?
Yeah.
Does that?
Well,
do they get paid by the hour?
Well, I think that there's some really bad writing shorthand there, because the agency would have hired a contractor, and the fee for the contractor would probably be a flat rate plus maybe penalties for running over or something to that effect. But the guy they're doing the painting, or the people they're doing the painting themselves, they weren't hired by Remington Steel Agency. They were hired by the contractor. Yeah. So they would probably be getting paid by the hour. But the contractor themselves probably would not be being paid by the hour. And so to have one of their people sitting there doing nothing because the client can't make up their mind. Yeah, that's a conversation. We're having a conversation over this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then she also tells Marion that Giovanni called for Marion again. How does he know to find Marion here? Knowing that Laura was there. Okay, maybe she put her work phone number down. Who knows? But Marion? How?
Well, you know, it's the same question we had with the sorority. How did they know to contact Laura under the guise of Pepler? How did they know to contact
her? I'm starting to think Glenn, Gordon, Karen secretly wrote this episode.
Under a pen name so he could collect the money and Well, you know, such things have happened where somebody writes a script or a story or something, and they have their name either removed or changed. Harlan Ellison did that on the pilot for Star Lost because it turned into such a mess in his opinion. And quite frankly, the show was a bit of a mess, but it turned out to be such a disaster that he didn't want his name associated with it. So he did it under a pen name.
Fair enough. So how would he
could be.
So he calls for Marion, wanting to arrange private sessions with her and Laura because he feels they are that good.
And you know, Steel, you can see where Steele's mind is racing. Yeah, you just see it.
Which, again, props to Brosnan for elevating this material, because his look, the look on his face, the man is insatiable. And then Marion lets it slip that he's the sculpture instructor, and that we see Steele, he's amused by this. So yeah, he decides to play with it. We switch back. He's reassured of the fact that Laura doesn't have two lovers, and he promises to find that Teddy is innocent no matter what.
Yeah, and I've got it written here.
Yikes.
Giving Marion hope, which he has no business doing.
Yeah. None whatsoever. This is, I mean, and I would expect that from him.
Mm-hmm.
It's Laura whose behavior is kind of perplexing, and her belief that Teddy is innocent despite tons of evidence that mounts up against him.
The only way you could even excuse what she's doing is that she's putting on a false front for Marion's sake. But there's no evidence of that. There's nothing in anything she says to Murphy or to Steele or to Bernice that indicates that that's what that is just a front to comfort Marion while they're trying to determine the facts. There's nothing. So yeah, it gives the impression that she honestly believes it. So yeah, to your question, why?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a very bizarre the whole thing. And then we switch back. Steele and Laura are in the limo. Now he knows about Giovanni. Here's where he reacts really childishly. He tells her that jealousy is a petty emotion, and what she does with Giovanni on Tuesday nights is her own affair. He tells her that his hopes for a fuller relationship were unrealistic, thanks her for setting him straight. And his little gambit pays off. She turns and begins to touch his suit, telling him that they needn't write anything in stone, but as usual, he screws the pooch and takes it too far. The phone rings, he answers it. It's Bernice on the other hand. Or on the other end, sorry. She tells him she waited until 11:30 and called. Now she wants to know why. Why the hell is she still at the office at 11:30?
You know, we've asked this question before in the High Flying Steel, where
That's true.
it was,
That's true.
you know, late in the evening and
It
she's still there taking
was
phone
very late.
calls.
Yeah,
Maybe
that
she's
is
got a
true.
room in the back and she's got a cot, you know, and a little kitchenette.
They don't let her leave. She lives there now.
Yes. She doesn't get paid well, but she's got room and board. I don't
And
know.
then Steele calls her Darlene and says, "I want you to come over, darling. You have a key, don't you?"
Oh.
Bernice knows something is off, demands to know what he's pulling, or she'll hang up. Is it just me, or was this really stupid on his part? Laura and Bernice talk.
Will this guy never learn? That's what I got written there. And
So not just me. Good to
no.
know.
And what's worse is that it's obviously a put on. It's his dialogue is like the bad dialogue
Oh
from a
my God,
bad
it's
movie
so
script,
bad.
and it's being said
It is
like he's a
so
bad
bad.
actor reading a bad dialogue from a bad movie script. It's
Yeah. 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 Ooh, Silk. I like Silk. Like, oh, it was cringy. It was,
Yeah.
I was like secondhand embarrassment all over
Yeah. Like I said, a bad
again.
dialogue from a bad script being delivered by a bad actor. That's how it
Yeah.
comes off.
Yeah.
And you know, props
Yeah.
to Brosnan because he did it well.
And
It's just that for Remington Steele, it's like you said, secondhand embarrassment, secondhand cringe. Oh.
here's also why this is really dumb. You have a key, don't you? Are we supposed to believe that if this is him trying to convince Laura that he has other women on the side, would he give them keys? No. Would he give Nadine a key? Like,
Who knows?
Miss Taplinger? I don't think she's got a key. Like, none of the women he's with he would give keys to. Like, that's. So why do it? Why is he pulling this little bit? Is he just ticked off that he assumed something? Or is he ticked off that Laura let him?
It's like a little kid who's, you know, somebody's got something that he wants, and so he's going to say the stupidest things that come to his head without thinking about
Yeah.
what he's saying, just to try to make them jealous. It's not even a good whitewash the fence scam. It's just a really
No.
bad one.
It is. It's really, and it's easily found out. Again,
Oh yeah.
Laura and Bernice talk.
Well, that just easily found out because, yeah, they do talk. And I have that later in my notes about why didn't Bernice say something to Laura about it when she had the chance.
Yeah.
But it's so
And just so you
transparent
know.
even at the time.
Yeah. And I mean, if I'm going to attempt to ascribe character development to this, which I'm not really able to do with Laura when it comes to why she didn't just say what it was, but if I'm going to make an attempt, because he does behave quite childishly in past episodes and will do so again, it's a knee-jerk thing. He clearly doesn't think it through. He's not able to express to her that it bothered him thinking that she was with another man. But neither is he able to let it go. So instead, he tries to make her feel the same way that he did, and it doesn't go well for him.
Yep.
Right? Laura gets angry. She kisses him.
A revenge kiss? Does that work?
Sure. And then storms out of the car, leaving him to reflect on his mistake. His lack of emotional maturity here just goes to show he's not used to feeling out of control. nor is he used to having his emotions out in the open. So that was my theory. Mm-hmm. He's not used to feeling vulnerable, so he attempts to regain the upper hand, and of course, it goes very poorly.
Mm-hmm. I still have to question that revenge kiss. I mean, it's...
Yeah, well, the script says that without warning, she grabs Steele and plants one of the medium's most inflammable kisses on him, then just as suddenly pulling away as she almost jumps out of his car. So I'm not sure I'd call that inflammable, but it was a kiss. So, yeah.
And then his line, love must truly be an enigma, Fred. I can't tell if I'm winning or losing. Well, if you're cheating, you're by definition losing because you're not playing the game. The only way you can win the game is if you play the game. If you're not playing by the rules, you're not playing that game. You know, one of the rules in Monopoly is not, you know, put $200 in the center every time you go around going. Then if you, you know, true, or to get out of jail or whatever it is that you do, that's not in the rules. And if you're playing it that way, you're playing a game that looks like Monopoly in a lot of respects, but you're not playing Monopoly. So you can't win at Monopoly.
Unless you're Captain Kirk. And as we've already discussed, this is
He still cheated. He changed the rules of the game. Therefore, it wasn't the same game.
Nerd.
Thank you.
But so... And this is another weird thing, because he says love must truly be an enigma. And my initial inclination is completely to dismiss the love part of this because it could just be an expression, right? But in the script, then this was taken out, and I can see why. There are 60 seconds of total honesty. He says, I think I might be falling dangerously in love with you. So I'm wondering if they were already playing with the idea of him being self-aware of this or not. I mean, it seems like they were, because, and I agree with them taking that line out because he's not there yet.
Yeah. It would have been too early.
Yeah. It would have seemed weird.
Yeah. And to say that it's love when you're trying to manipulate somebody like that. Again, you're trying to cheat the game and you can't win when you're cheating.
I mean, I think he definitely has deep feelings for her at this point, and he's like a little kid that doesn't know what to do with them. I definitely think that that's the case, but I don't think he would be self-aware enough to be like, oh, I'm in love with her. Because at this point, he didn't know what he's doing.
Yeah, no. Not a clue.
So then Laura gets home. She's upset. She goes to turn on her light. Someone grabs her by the neck. It's Teddy. Mm-hmm. And tells her if she screams, it's all over.
Way to make yourself endearing to the audience, Teddy.
Wow. Okay. And then we'll go back to Teddy. We switch to Mr. Steele. He comes to his apartment. He says he sees the door has been, like, the lock on his door has been destroyed, basically.
Yes.
And that causes him to deduce that Leo is there. Which is great. He walks in. Don't shoot, Leo. And then, of course, we switch back to Laura's house. And this is where she's bringing Teddy milk and a sandwich. He apologizes for scaring her, says he's a wreck because he's been set up twice. Why has she not called the police? Like, why, Laura? Why?
Ethics?
Yeah. But for her own personal safety, he grabbed her. He told her not to scream. Like, if I were her, I'd
he apologized.
I don't understand.
That makes it okay.
Help me.
He apologized. That makes it fine.
Make it make sense. She asked if he left the loft to look for Rena's will. In it, it shows that Rena didn't leave him the paintings after all. She sold them to the consortium. Teddy is hoping it clears him, but Laura points out that he didn't even know about it. Teddy, which to her should be a red flag, but it's not. Teddy says he doesn't want to go back to the loft. He gives Laura the key, which of course becomes important later. And then she tells him to spend the night with her.
Yeah. And
for those of you who can't see me, I am face palming repeatedly. I don't.
Well, you know, for One thing I had written in my notes here is during this conversation, he says, well, I'm no Einstein. It's like, well, yeah.
Really? Really? You think?
You know, and of course, when she says spend the night with her, he thinks, you know, she's offering herself and turns her down. And I'm kind of, I'm kind of mixed in my thoughts about this. She's annoyed at the presumption that she was offering herself to him. But I kind of wonder if she's not also annoyed that everybody keeps turning her down.
I mean, maybe. my notes, I have Teddy being as dumb as a potted plant, says he's sworn off fooling around. And Laura, irritated, clarifies she meant on the couch. So, could be. Yep. It's nice to be wanted, I suppose.
Yeah. Even if you don't want to be wanted, it's kind of nice to be wanted. Yeah.
So then we switch back. Leo wants to team up with Steele. He believes that if they find the paintings, they find the killer. Obviously, we know that Leo has... Did he kill Rena? I mean, she fell, but either way, he's responsible for her death. Mm-hmm. He offers to split the finder's fee with Steele as long as he dumps baby doll, meaning Laura.
That one I've got a comment on later.
He claims she's an albatross, which is funny because the albatross was a ship's good luck charm until some idiot killed it. Watch Firefly. That is a direct quote. Yeah, so... He also claims she was a secretary 1 week and then a detective another, which, of course, premise for the show. Mm-hmm. And Steele tells Leo they'll get through the case and see afterwards and ushers him out the door, making him promise to get another lock.
Yeah. One little minor question I had that really has nothing to do significantly with the scene. Leo is eating a sandwich and he makes a comment about, if you eat a man's liver, worst.
Pate.
And Steele says, well, actually, it's pate. Isn't liverwurst actually a form of pate?
I thought it was. But I'm not up enough on pate because, like, I am not fine dining.
Me neither.
So I don't know.
to my wife and I, fine dining is going to Red Robin.
Yeah. We don't have Red Robin here, but I guess the equivalent would be something
similar. Tim Hortons. No, Tim not Hortons, Tim Hortons.
Yep.
No, not Tim Hortons.
I thought it was. I don't.
Yeah.
Email us. Yes. Message us. Let us know. So, anyway. Steele shows up at Laura's the next day. Mm-hmm. He tries to tell her about Leo. She thinks he's talking about Darlene and cuts him off. She tells him they should keep their private lives private. He hears the shower going, notices a pair of men's trousers, phone rings. Bernice, on the other end, she's surprised that he's there. She's irritated with him. She tells him that Spriggs called and wants to meet them at the gallery. Steele notices the bug in Laura's lamp.
Leo?
He says, you got that, Leo? I like.
Her look on her face when he says that is like, what?
Yeah. And of course, still trying to explain the Darlene situation, Laura is now not letting him, which is getting a bit tired. They arrive at the gallery. Steele has obviously told her about Leo's proposal, and he mentions that he thinks that Leo thinks they might be overstaffed. Really? Who does he suggest we should cut? And before he gets a chance to respond to her, when she asks who Leo thinks they should cut, they hear the noise. They go towards the back. Spriggs exits the back room, falls down in front, still talking about Anita and her soap operas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Sure.
Yeah.
Leo comes in. And here's where I felt like I was still on the Leo killed Spriggs train at this point, because I have supposedly finds and quotes Spriggs and follows Steele and Laura out. Mm-hmm. Laura notices the palm trees and the paintings. Steele references It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World, pointing out that the film, the money was hidden underneath the palm trees. Laura agrees. And then they go and find the house, right? Mm-hmm. They arrive there. They get to the house. It's funny watching Leo try to climb the wall.
Well, can we go back to the gallery real quick? This is where I start having a little bit of an issue, because in the gallery, she says, Teddy didn't kill Spriggs, but if we can find the paintings, then we also find the killer, Devereaux perhaps. And then he says, you hit the kitten on the head, baby doll. And it's like, why why didn't she respond or react more to that? I mean, that's a pretty condescending term. I mean, we know Leo used it already once with Steele back in the apartment, but that was with the two of them. She wasn't there, so she didn't overhear it. And Steele, you know, I can understand why Steele might have ignored it at that point, but wouldn't she have reacted more than she did here? And then he does it again to her later at the at the house. So it just, I don't know if she's...
I actually had that question for later.
Okay.
Yeah, I had that question for later when Leo tells her to stay behind because things might get rough. And I'm like, my literal words are, why doesn't she tell Leo to go to hell? Because he's already called her baby doll once. And yeah, at this point.
I mean, I can understand that she... My first thought is she's the kind of person who would not ignore that. She would say something or do something about that. But on the other hand, I guess you could make an argument that, well, we know what kind of person Leo is. Mm-hmm. Is it going to change Leo to make an issue of it?
No.
So is it worth the effort to make the issue of it? So you can make the argument that way, but it's just her lack of response, even just kind of a more dramatic, excuse me, yes, even if it's just on interface, that one, that one kind of was like, again, a little bit out of character, but.
No, I agree. Cause she doesn't react at all to Leo for most of. So
yeah,
not going to disagree with that.
And then here we get the movie reference. It's a mad, 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 mad world.
And then we've got the, they arrive at the house. Laura, when Steele asks how Laura knew that Teddy didn't kill Spriggs, Laura tells him that Teddy was at her house. Laura and Steele try to get through the door. It's locked. Leo attempts to bust it down, but it's solid wood, which was also funny. I like this as a running joke in the show where they're, you know, Murphy's always wanting to bust a door down and never gets to do it. And then Leo tries it and ends up smacking into the wall. And then, of course, they head into the room. Leo stops her. Things might get rough. They open a door to the closet. Devereaux makes a run for it. He gets by both Steele and Leo. And then Laura hits him with a chair, WWE style, and he falls to the ground. Which, of course, Leo then says, nice work, Steele.
Yeah, those doors are really, really tough, but those chairs are really cheap.
Chairs are... So here's the part where, like I said, I got confused, and I'm leaning towards Devereaux being Spriggs's killer, because at first, and my notes say, like, Devereaux admits that he was Rena's accomplice and that Spriggs panicked. He maintains he didn't kill Rena, as he didn't have the paintings. And so my notes are, does this mean he killed Spriggs? Are there two killers here? And then the script says, Devereaux, all right, for God's sakes, I killed Spriggs. The little worm was going to go to the police. Now, they cut that line out, obviously. But they cut that line out. They cut out Remington saying, so it was you and he who staged Rena's murder. He says Spriggs didn't know anything about it. He just put in the money for the paintings. Then he panicked when things started to go wrong. And then she says, you mean after you killed Rena? I didn't kill Rena. And then he says, no, I swear, why would I kill Rena? She's hidden the paintings somewhere. She was going to get them when she was really killed. Until I had those paintings, Rena was much more valuable to me alive than dead, right? So you could make the argument that they changed their mind on Devereaux being the other killer. But then Steele says, and this they did keep, because Leo keeps threatening to hurt him, right?
Right.
Steele makes the comment, he's already confessed.
Yeah.
So
that line is in there, but he didn't actually confess. And here's the problem. Devereaux was the art critic who was involved in the scheme, but was he the one who was going to be working on getting the paintings? Because earlier in the episode, we saw Spriggs looking at the slides and wanting to know where the paintings were. He hadn't gotten them yet.
No.
But I'm not certain that Devereaux was really the one that was going to be getting them, because Spriggs would have had to have been the dealer that they go through to sell them. So,
right. Yeah.
So would Rena have given them to Devereaux to take to Spriggs, or would Rena have taken them straight to Spriggs? Because presumably she knows that Spriggs is involved. And so
yeah,
it would be less risky to just go from one person to the next person rather than going through a second person's hands to get to that person. So I don't know that Devereaux necessarily knew where the paintings were either. And if that's the case...
No, he doesn't. He admits he doesn't.
Okay. Then Spriggs would be potentially of value to him alive, because if Devereaux doesn't know where the paintings are, Spriggs might. So why would you kill him if he's
the part that they did keep in was that that Spriggs had begun to panic and was going back on their deal. So arguably he could have killed him because Spriggs was threatening to go to the authorities. Mm-hmm. Didn't want to be a part of it anymore.
They didn't do any service to the script by making some of these changes, because you do say the original script.
It should have been kept in.
Yeah, because as it is right now, we really don't have a clear definitive answer as to who killed Spriggs. And so that's why I presumed it was Leo.
I did too until I watched and I was really making notes on the scene. And then I thought about... The reason I lean towards it being Devereaux is also because Leo is such a doof, and he admits to Rena's death being a result of, you know, she ran, he chased her. It for all intents and purposes was not intended to happen.
Right.
And he's not able to shoot Laura and Remington. He holds a gun right up to them and he's just not able to do it. And not for a second does Remington think he's going to, or he wouldn't stand right in front of the gun.
That's true.
So I think that they pegged his character pretty simply as a man who was desperate, but not desperate. If he was desperate enough to stab Spriggs in the back, then he probably would have shot Laura and Steele to finish what he was trying to do. I can't.
Yeah, that's true. It's not real clear. My first inclination is to say it's bad writing or sloppy writing. The fact that it was originally in the script that Devereaux confesses directly to having killed Spriggs.
Oh yeah,
kind of mitigates my criticism of the writing. But yeah, at some point, they lost the plot.
It's muddy. It's definitely muddy. Yes. And you're right. They should have kept that in. So they go to the loft. I'm wondering if Devereaux has confessed to murder, what'd they do with him? Did they call him the police? Like, did they just leave him there?
Yeah.
So they go to the loft. Presumably they've just left Devereaux.
Left him sitting in one of those chairs that breaks so easily that he could probably just back up against the wall and the thing would collapse and I'm free now.
Yeah, woohoo! Hello, Mexico. Yes. So yeah, they leave him there, I guess. Yeah. Leo opens the loft with his key. Steele reasons that if Rena knew about Teddy and Marion, she likely knew about the loft. They start rifling through the paintings and don't find them. This is a neat little callback to Thou Shalt Not Steal, because Laura asks Steele, right, if I were to hide a set of paintings. And Steele finishes the question by saying he would put them right in front of her nose. Mm-hmm. Which is exactly what he did in Thou Shalt Not Steal. He left the painting in the museum, right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I thought that was a cute little moment there. And then he then clues in, grabs the painting with a somewhat sort of worn canvas, tears it off, which...
yeah.
to reveal Rena's painting underneath. And this is where Leo kind of gives himself away. He keeps insisting on taking the paintings to the black market. Laura points out they still don't know who Rena's killer is. Leo attempts to pin it on Devereaux and then Spriggs, both of which Laura dismisses. Leo then suggests that it doesn't matter because if they've got the paintings, the golden goose. And then, of course, she notices that Leo had the key. And she points out that he had Teddy's key. Leo begins to panic. Do you think he dismissed Laura earlier because he genuinely thought she wasn't competent, or because he somewhat felt threatened because she was? Because he does acknowledge that line you mentioned, you hit the kitten on the head, baby doll. He is acknowledging that she somewhat knows what she's talking about. So I wonder if his dismissal of her earlier was more, oh, shoot, she's really the brains behind the situation. Or is he not that bright?
I'm tempted to say that both are true.
Okay.
I mean, he's really not that bright. He's not that good of a detective. And
no, he is not.
So it's a bit presumptuous to think that he would realize that Laura is a real threat and that his efforts are anything more than just to try and ingratiate himself with a guy that he thinks is this big time detective, because he'll be able to get away with his current scheme and have the best of both worlds. But on the other hand, it does seem that he was making a concerted effort to try and push her out of the scene.
Yeah.
And you'd have to ask, well, why do that? It can't just be about the future partnership, you know, Blitzman and Steele.
No.
Steele and Blitzman.
Steele and Blitzman.
You know,
it kind of went beyond misogyny for misogyny's sake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, and it could be that initially he did just dismiss her, but then at the last minute, it finally dawned on him and he panicked.
Yeah, it could be.
I'll say C, course, all of the above.
All of the above. And then this is where, I mean, this is a sweet moment in an otherwise fairly iffy case in terms of the writing. Leo provides a good foil for Laura and Steele, but it's clear that Steele has some sympathy for him. And as he usually does, he said, you know, just the look on Brosnan's face, he does this so well when he clues in and he just sort of says, oh, Leo, and just seems sad for him.
You're a detective.
He says, doesn't that mean anything? What does this line mean to you? Because this is a good one.
Yeah. You know, I thought about that line and I didn't come up with a good way of expressing. Obviously, he views or has come to view being a detective as, I don't want to say something that's noble, but something about it that has a certain responsibility, a level of responsibility, a level of self-pride in, hey, I'm a detective. That means something. I'm not just some guy that digs through the dirty laundry, and as the song says, it's something that is to be proud of, which is kind of interesting, because that is exactly the opposite of who Remington Steele was at the very beginning of all of this. I mean, he was not only not a detective, but detectives were bad news to him. They were a danger to him. And yet he's.
And yeah, I think I agree in the sense that, to me, I felt like he was starting to see Laura's profession as something he respects and, as you said, admires. He sees value in what they do. And to see Leo just throw it all away is disappointing for him, I think. Even though Leo is not good at what he does, and he's very much kind of sleazy. Yeah, there's a certain level of pride that he's starting to take in their work, and he's seen that they're helping people, and that even, I think, as a con man, there were certain lines he wouldn't cross and certain codes, morality-wise, that he had. So to him, I think this is, to see Leo break those codes, it would be similar to seeing a con man break whatever codes they had set as well. And yeah, so he's sad about it. And I really like that. It elevates, again, what is ultimately kind of not that interesting as a case and turns it into something a bit more, which I like.
Yeah. I think also you got to bring Laura into that statement as well, because I don't, how to put it. I think it's kind of an acknowledgement on his part of Laura's value and worth and her abilities as a detective, and kind of speaks of the respect that he has for her abilities as a detective.
Yeah.
You know, she's made him see what being a detective is, what it's about. And it's almost a type of an acknowledgement of her, in a sense, I guess. Yeah.
Which I think then makes it a better line than if he had actually said, I'm falling dangerously in love with you.
Yeah.
This, I think, is more of a on a deeper level, recognizing who she is as a person,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Laura says that Leo will have to kill them to get away with it. Neither of them look scared. So obviously they understand that Leo's not going to do it. They take the gun from him and they offer some sort of comfort to him, which is kind of sweet. So back in the office, Steele has decided to leave the paint color the same.
Trustworthy gray.
Which manages to piss off Daryl. Which I ask, if he's getting paid by the hour, then why does he care?
Well, because the gravy train's over. They've picked the color. Now true. He's going to have to actually do the job and go on.
His choice. Laura agrees. The door opens. Marion and Teddy come in carrying Laura's sculpture. I like this bit. Steele asks what they're taking into his office, and Teddy replies, a hernia, which is cute. They announce that they are getting married. Oh, congrats. Yay. And that he's no longer going to live off other people. He announces this as if it's some sort of accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. He says he's taken up a new profession that is respectable and dependable.
Yeah.
He's going to be a painter.
Yeah.
Dumb as a sack of rocks.
I hope what he's talking about is painting houses.
Yeah, maybe he's going to talk to Daryl and get into the union.
Hey, there you go. Get paid by the hour to wait around for somebody to decide on the paint color. Yes.
Trustworthy gray. Oh, my gosh. And then Steele, this is the part where they've actually got the 60 seconds of total honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I kind of wonder about this because Steele can't for a second think that anything happened with that ding-dong Teddy. Can he?
Well, if he acted like he believed it had, it would just be an act for the purpose of something, of trying to make her believe that he believed it. But no, I mean, rationally speaking, how could he? I mean, she's got more class than that.
Yeah. But he's the one that suggests the 60 seconds of total honesty. I mean, arguably, she's the one that's wondering about Darlene. I mean, he knows that there are no lovers and he knows that Teddy that nothing happened between her and the great himbo. So,
you know, that dialogue there between the two of them, I had kind of a problem with it simply because it was, okay, maybe you can create the argument that they were saying things to the other that the other didn't know 100% was
true.
But it almost seemed like, oh, let me tell you something you already know, and I'm going to pretend like it's some great revelation.
Yeah.
It kind of, on second watch, third watch, fifth watch, note-taking watch, as was the case here.
Note-taking watch, that's what it is.
It just kind of fell flat for me because it was like, okay, let me state the obvious. Okay. Now you state the obvious. Okay. Yeah. Now we both have stated something obvious and we're going to act like we've been profound.
And you're wasting your minute.
Yes.
Why on earth did she not lead with what is your name?
Yeah.
This would have been question number one for me because that's more important than whether or not Darlene is real. I think she knows there's no Darlene. Come on. She's not dumb.
Yeah. I mean, he's pulled this act before.
Yeah. So then also, I used a timer to see if it was because he claims time is up when she gets to the real name question. And it was not. They had 10 more seconds. So there should have been a timer involved is all I'm saying, because she would have been able to. Yeah. What is your real name? That is the first thing you ask.
Yeah.
The first. Like, come on, Laura. And then she she asks him about the sculpture, whether or not he likes it. He says it's inspired, which is a good non-answer.
Mm-hmm.
And she asks if he's being honest. That's what we're doing here, isn't it? Okay, sure.
But... Well, it's an honest answer. I mean, it's not a useful answer. It's not an informative answer.
Well, that's like saying, do you like my hair? It's different.
Yeah. It's an honest answer. Yes. It's different than it was.
anything else? Because that's the end. That's the tag.
That's the end. You know, when we were talking about the script earlier and discussing the merits of it, a thought flipped through my head, and I didn't say it at the time, but I guess I'll go ahead and say it now. You know, Steel and the Chips got a real bad rap for a long time by a lot of people, that it was just a stupid, meaningless, fluffy script. And I'm thinking, even if you don't think Steel and the Chips was a great script, I think it was better than this one. And this is not the sort of thing I want to be saying about any scripts. Yeah. And, you know, it's not what comments I want to make about Remington Steel in this podcast. But, you know, I just got to be honest. This was not one of the greatest scripts.
No. And I am not a huge fan of Steel and the Chips as an episode, mm-hmm. but I am willing to, I mean, on a rewatch, that opinion might change. Like, I'm willing to acknowledge that my opinions on that episode might be skewed, having not the background knowledge I have of it now. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to go into it with fresh eyes, because I might enjoy it more, I think, now than I did before. Who knows? But yeah, I think, and I don't think it's necessarily, I mean, it's not like we're sitting here saying this whole show is terrible and we hate it. It was mm-hmm. just, this was not a strong episode. It's not a strong outing. They can't all be perfect. It's miles better than a lot of other things that were on TV at the time. Oh, yeah. So,
well, and we talked about this early on. We talked about it early on, how even at its lowest point, Remington Steel was still better than 95% of the stuff that was on TV at the time.
For sure. For sure. So I just think it had some weak moments that were not really clearly expanded on when they could have been. And it could have, I think the problem that I had with it is I saw the potential for it that just didn't get realized, which was a shame.
And what I saw was, and I agree absolutely that with you, that there was potential in this script. What I was looking at was all the stuff that just didn't make sense within the context of the story, and how so much of it seemed to be written for the sake of the joke rather than the story. Yeah. So anyway.
No, I agree. So
that's all I got.
But onwards and upwards on the website, www.steelwatching.com. We've got show notes. We've got links to Amazon, even though there's no longer a, what was it before? That
we Amazon that it was called? Associates or, yeah.
Associates, yeah. You can still get the links to, I think it's Laura and It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World.
You left out two mads.
Mad World. I always forget how many are in there.
I do too.
So you can go there and find all that stuff. And there are also social media resources and links, such as?
Links to the official Steel Watching Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages. Links to the Steel Watchers fan group on Facebook. And like we mentioned earlier, some links that you can choose to help support the show financially.
And the next episode is one of my personal favorites of season one.
It's a good one.
It's not one that normally gets mentioned when it comes to like the good quote unquote episodes of season one. It's not Vintage Steel or Thou Shalt Not.
That's true.
It's Steel in the News. So
it's a very good one. Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that one.
I am too. And it's mine. So should be fun.
Yeah, it's yours. So though you've got the wheel. You have the helm.
Well, I've got nothing else.
No, I think we're good. So thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everybody. Eric and Sarah here. Just a quick announcement to let you know that Yes, we do appreciate everyone who listens, participates, and supports the podcast in whatever way you do. But we wanted to give an extra thank you to those who are so graciously giving to be monthly financial supporters.
We are making live streams of our recording sessions available to anyone who is a monthly financial supporter. So not only can you watch us live as we record our podcast episodes, you will be getting access to the raw, behind-the-scenes, unedited version of episodes before they get officially released.
And Sarah, does that include our mistakes and screw-ups and our humiliating?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it does. Every single one of them.
Every single one of them, yes. So again, this is just an extra thank you to those who are going above and beyond. But whether you choose to become a monthly financial supporter or not, we still love you. We want to say we thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your feedback.
If you want to become a monthly financial supporter, please visit our website at www.steelwatching.com to sign up.